Session number 17156, Reel 2.
Mr. Chapman, Reel 2.
Yes, I was put into a room on the first floor of this interrogation place, and below me, I was overlooking a kindergarten. Young children there, very, very, very funny. A little girl wanted to do a big job, so she didn't know that I could see her, so she squatted down to the side of a bush and ran away looking very, very self-conscious. Then every 10 minutes or so she was bringing her friends up and showing it to them. And I found it very amusing in my circumstances. Anyway, cut a long story short, They wouldn't let, I wanted to pee and they wouldn't let me, and I was in agony. So I said, for God's sake, I couldn't tell them anything. They thought what I told them was nonsense about air sea rescue. I thought I was some sort of secret service. So I said, if you don't let me have a pee, I'll piss all over the floor. So they came in then. And I said, fortunately, I've got a big bladder because I was in the wine trade. So when they heard that, they sent a chap in who'd been in the wine trade. And so he bought in a couple of bottles of wine. So he said, oh, I'd like to talk to you. And he was hoping to get me drunk. Anyway, the time they carried him out, they gave up. I was much better training than he was. I could take my liquor in there. So anyway, I went down into the camp proper. And to my utter amazement, the very first man I met was John Casson, who, funnily enough, my last term in Worcester, I was his cadet captain. He and his brother Christopher were in my top, as they call it, my division, and there was John Casson, and he'd been kept as an interrogation camp because he was a well-known fellow through his father, John Casson, the actor, and his mother, Sybil Thorndike. I remember when Sybil came down to the Worcester when I was his cadet captain, we were introduced, and she gave me a 10-bob note and asked me to be kind to them. And John was kept there, thinking because he was a figurehead, might talk, because all the light plugs, light holes in the ceiling were all wired up, and they were hoping to get information. So anyway, they couldn't get anything out of me. So I then went into the camp proper and was moved to Spangenberg. I went into the village to begin with. It was an old medieval, lovely medieval village, and I was in there with the Grand Blessé, the badly wounded who were due to be shipped back, and I met Nigel Courage's brewery there, who lost a leg, and I was there for a few days. Then I was moved up to the Schloss, the castle, which was another Colditz. It was very primitive. And
in what way was it another Colditz? You mean it was for bad boys?
No. Well, in structure, it was just, you know, an old medieval castle. And I've got some pictures of it here if you want to see it.
We can look at them later.
And anyway. It's now a swept up and very expensive hotel for game shooting, wild boar hunting and things like that. In those days, it had been a centre for trainee Hitler youth to teach them the rules, and it was very, very crude. Anyway, we had all we had was a courtyard. It was only about about 60 feet long and about 40 feet wide to do our exercise. It was dreadful, confined. And we had Bader, the legless wonder, came. He was an absolute bastard. He nearly got us shot several times.
In what way?
Well, in particular instance, the goons, which we called the Germans, the word goon came from a strip cartoon in the Mirror before the war, where these goons were some mysterious sort of gremlin race of people, and they had hair over their heads and hair from their hairy arms over their hands. That's what the goons looked like in their winter gear, the sentries. So that's why we call them goons. Anyway, what was I saying?
You were saying that Bader nearly got you shot.
Oh, yes, Bader, the guards were changing over in the courtyard, and he dropped an empty tin can on one of their helmets, and they all opened up fire, and he was laughing his bloody head off. He was down below the window ledge, and at this recessed window, the bullets were going. There were 200 chaps in that room. All the ceilings and ceiling and walls were all spattered with bullets. He was laughing his head off, and I understand that when he was in, his tin legs were dropped to him. He was in hospital in France, and he heard of three chaps who were recovering from their wounds in this ward who were going to be taken away by the French organisation and shipped over the frontier into Spain. So he insists upon going. So they tied the sheets together. And of course, when he landed, he made such a noise that they were heard and all captured. And anyway, they knew they must have got some help from inside, so all the hospital staff were connected with the ward were tortured. And a little girl confessed that she'd put them up to it, and she and 25 others, she gave the names of, were shot by the Gestapo, thanks to Douglas Bader. That's the God's truth.
This is at Spangenberg?
No. Yes, one at Spangenberg. But no, when the 26 were shot, when he was in hospital, when his tin legs were dropped, the Germans allowed that to happen, as you know, because he was Bader until he arrived. Then, of course, he realised that Bader was German, and they thought he was marvellous, thought he was a god. He got away with the murder.
But when he dropped the tin can on the German guard's helmet, that was at Spangenberg.
Yeah, they didn't know who it was. They thought, they made a hell of a noise. So of course, the guards just instinctively started open fire. You imagine the castle was about 4 feet thick, the wall, and this sloping window in like this, so they could shoot muskets out of it, or the bows and arrows, or what it was.
But the escape attempt was from a hospital.
Yeah, that's when he had his tin legs, when he was, that was in France, yes. I forget where it was in France. They did tell me. He was there at the time.
Did you come into personal contact with Bader?
Oh, rather, yes. Yes, he after the war, he lived just in a mews just behind me in Kensington. But he was so detested. Another time, when we were at Warburg, there was a big Army, Navy and Air Force chaps there, and it was snowing, and Bader used to come in with a three-legged stool. He didn't come in because he had a rank, it was Winker, and he had a little room and a big... A sick man, he had this special concession. He just used to come out to be bloody aggravating. Anyway, he made a snowboard as a marvellous shot, and he knocked the goon who was carrying has knocked his cap off, so the Germans opened fire. And we were lying in the snow, face down, 40 degrees of frost, and we were there, until we became the Duke of Argyle afterwards. What was his the name leading up to that? He was an army type, a great character, and the Red Cross had delivered band instruments prior to this, and he couldn't play the drum, but he put the drum on and got some chaps, and they marched through the goons and that, and broke the tension. But he was a lovely chap, became the Duke of Argyle.
So this was another occasion when Bardas betting of the guards led to the remodeling fight.
Another thing too was when he mucked up an escape. When the winter was coming, the Red Cross arranged to have gear that had been taken from various armies. So I was given a pair of, I think they were Polish army boots, a pair of Belgian trousers and a Belgian greatcoat. I looked at absolute prat. And we were going in tens to the Vorlage, where the front part of the camp, where the clothing store was, in a hut. So one of the chaps put up an escape. The goon who was counting us couldn't count properly. We were still going out in tens. They were going out at 11 and coming back 13 and 9. The old boy just couldn't count when he was on duty, so he puts up an escape. So Bader was a big X then, and he insisted upon going. So, of course, he got down there, got to the clothing store, and this chap, I can't give his name now, he was next to him, Picklock, and the clothing store was on a slope, and they were going to get on the lower side of the slope, which would take him on the back of the German huts. The shutters came through, and a bolt went right through it to the inside with a padlock on. Conigan's chap's name, he picked the lock on this thing, pushed the bolt out and opened the thing. And of course, made a such a bloody noise when he jumped out that they were apprehended. So the escape was messed up. That's typical of him.
So he seemed to want to always be teasing the German
guy. He thought he was God. Well, he got shot up showing off. That's how he lost his legs. He was shooting up his girlfriend's house. He was flew too low and just crashed into the ground. How he was allowed to fly again. I'll give him credit. He was a great example to legless people. That was anything to his advantage, but that was typical of him, because he loved showing off. He was so utterly selfish. I've never known a man like it. Well, one of the chaps who went in the theatre business became manager of a theatre in London, and he invited 30 of us who lived in the London area as his guests to the opening of a play. I don't know what it was, and Bader lives just at the back of me. And in the Mews were, and he was there, not a soul spoke to him. He was absolutely isolated, he was completely ignored. So he didn't see the show, he went off at the half-time interval. That's it. Anyway.
Which years were you in Spangenberg?
Although only for a few months. We were there from. From the 8th of May till there were a lot of very interesting people there. Rupert Davis was.
This is May Gray.
May Gray, yes, he was Earl Worcester, and he was a very, very close friend, particularly for that reason. And a
close friend of yours?
Oh, yes. Well, that's a result of being an old Worcester, and he's in the same room. And he was in the next bunk to me, on top bunk. And we used to chat at night. But don't put this on the machine for a minute. But, yeah.
Any memories of Rupert Davis?
Oh, rather. He was a great actor. Marvellous shows he used to put on. And Peter Butterworth, who later did the Carry On series, he was in the same room as well. Peter, we were great, very great friends. But I went to both their funerals.
Were they both good men?
Oh, charming fellows, yes. Yes, they were. They did so much to keep up the morale of the... I mean, you can imagine, they were mostly kids. I was an old man, you see. Well, I was in my 30s, well, in my 30s. And I realised how lost they were. They had no purpose. So I set about giving talks. I used to talk on... All said that when they'd been in the bag long enough, they'd have enough money to take a country pub. So I used to give a talk, I think I'll give a country pub. And I used to, my prisoner of war number was 1342. And I used to prefix every talk I gave, Chapman's a name, 1342 Sandeman's Port. I used to say that, it was quite a joke. And because I was in the SC rescue branch, Peter Bressy, one of the chaps there, nicknamed me Tugboat Ted. So I was known amongst the dinners, I'm known as Tugboat Ted.
But you were deliberately trying to keep up morale.
Yes, that's right. So I started giving these talks, and I was crowded. So then I realised they knew nothing. So I don't know, I'd heard of this institute of sales manager or something, which one of the chaps got some, his parents had sent his papers through to him, you see, so he came to me, he said, could I help him? So I through the Red Cross, I got in touch with the institute of sales managers, and I got six chaps through. And one of the early reunions, they were all came up congratulating me, because in those days chaps were coming back from the war, there were dozens of jobs and nobody with experience, and all these chaps had landed tip top jobs because they had this knowledge to convey, and talk on wine and sales management. I'd always give them a chat about something. Oh, then I learned German very well, and I used to teach German. You know, Robert Key on television, KW, I taught him German. He was my star pupil. And it was a great asset to be able to speak German, I can assure you, because during the great show, I went in the... I used to carry the wooden horse. Ollie Philpott, who organised that, I told him he wanted a gymnast. We were very great friends. And he said, any good on a horse, fording horse? So I said, yes, all right. So would you like to give us a start? So that's when I first realised my knee was messed up. I jumped off the springboard. And instead of clearing the horse, my instep caught on it, and I went sprawling, fortunately, into the sand. But so that's when I realised my leg was gammy. But because I got no treatment when I was a prisoner of war, and it's all catching up on me now in my old age. But the wooden horse used to have a little chap inside, and by God, it weighed a ton carrying it out. I still used to participate. They used to be watching what was going on. And it was right underneath a goon box, one of these sentry boxes. It was only just right at the foot of it. And because a little chap would go in inside, and all round the bag were bags of made for the legs of long pants. They used to make these sacks, and then we tie them to our waist. And walk round the circuit, doing our parade round the circuit, and the sand would gradually ooze along and be trampled in, and so we dispose of it. But
is this still in Spangenberg?
No, the Great Escape. That was at Stand of Three. Now Spangenberg. We moved from Spangenberg to Warburg, the mixed army camp, and. Well, I told you about the...
Stalag Luft 3 is a Zagan, isn't it?
Zagan, that's right, yes, which is now Polish.
And Oliver Philpott did a home run, I think. He successfully escaped.
Did he in the end? No, he didn't. He might have later on. I don't think he did. But anyway,
you were helping with the wooden horse escape.
Oh, rather, yes, because I was with my German. I was quite a good artist actually. I've lost the power of this through this nerve here.
In your hand.
Yes, and I can't draw very well now, but I was forging papers. They're damn good they were too. Yeah, they looked like printed papers. I could copy them absolutely, and I used to talk to the goons. I never smoked, and the Red Cross, you've got to remember the beginning of the war when we were captured, the Germans were trying to be friendly with the Americans, hoping they wouldn't come in. And from the first, right up until the Americans came in, they were very, very nice, you know. And it was quite extraordinary that we got Red Cross parcels and things like that. Well, of course, after that, they gradually dwindled down. That's why we were quite fit, because of the food. Well, then when after that, it began to get worse and worse and worse. And God, I weighed 15 stone. I had an 18-inch bicep, so I could do the crucifix on the ring. That was quite tough. And rowing and boxing and gymnastics, I was a good all-rounder. And blow me, when I came back, when I escaped from the Russians, I'll tell you about that presently, I was weighed with my Polish boots, my Belgian trousers and all this gear, and a kit bag that the Americans had given me, where I had a few souvenirs in. And can you see underneath that?
We'll look at it afterwards.
Okay. Unfortunately... When I was weighed, I weighed 84 pounds, a lot. Great coat, boots, 6 stone. I lost 9 stone. And I'll show you a picture of like a bloody skeleton. Anyway, I went to the hospital and I wanted to get home. I wanted to see my daughter. She was growing up. We lived in Buxton in those days because I was with Sandeman, and fortunately my wife was safe. And what a farce too in Buxton, though. They were all with ICI, Imperial Chemical Industries, and had all these lime pits all around there, which I was digging out, and all the locals, they all got in the Home Guard, and they're all majors. They wore riding breeches and riding boots and Sam Browns and carried pistols. You'd never see such prats. And they talked about the bomb while the German was offloading. He'd been on a raid further north, and he offloaded a bomb 7 miles away up on the moors. I think it might have killed a rabbit or something, the bomb. But they were always promoting each other. When I got back, it was nauseating because my poor missus, she worked in Westminster Bank and did various other work during the war, and looked after my daughter. And all these people, cars, of course, they needed their cars. And they wouldn't give her a lift. They were a lot of so-and-sos. They really were. Changing. And I had the pleasure when the Japanese prisoner came back, and I went into a hotel there, I forget which one now, and I was invited to go. So when they arrived, I said, don't be a bullshit. Let these buggers bullshit you. I said, they've all been scrounging and having a bloody good time. Well, as I was in Germany, I'd never such a bad time as you, but they don't mean a bloody word they say. And thank God I mucked up. The chaps were very friendly with me. We had a little booze up on our own. It was dreadful.
But that's after the war. If we can come back to your POW experience,
yes.
What other memories have you got of being in Stalag Luft 3? Can we go on to when the Russians started?
Yes, well, first of all, we're in Stalag Luft 3. Then we had I picked up a bug in Stalag Luft 3, and I was going to give a talk on wines, and I've got a picture I just cut of me. Well, a chap did a cartoon of me. I showed it to the president, and he gave this talk on wines. Unfortunately, I was taken ill, and I was in the hospital all over Christmas. That was 44. And I came out at midday, and 9 o'clock that night, we went on the start of the winter march. I was in a terrible state. Anyway, fortunately, someone made a sledge, and I was able to put my meagre things on it, and then we went off. It was extraordinary that we stayed in a hayloft. That was the best night of all. The next to the night where we stayed in a glass factory, all these blokes making, blowing glass, and we peeled off and dried ourselves out, and we sat in amongst the room where the moulds are kept. Oh, most extraordinary that was. And then eventually we got in cattle trucks, and there was just a pee hole. We were locked in this bloody cattle truck for 3 days. We couldn't do big jobs. We were bursting. Imagine the muck we get given. But anyway, we could pee through this hole in the corner, and there were about 40 of us to a truck. We could only sort of squat. We couldn't lie down even. And anyway, eventually we stopped at a siding, and we were allowed to get out. We sat on this blessed wall. God, absolute agony. I've never bled so much in my life. You know, a big... Anyway, that's an unhappy memory. Yes.
Did you see much of the German civilians on this march?
No, we're in the truck. We finished up at Luckenwalde, and that was dreadful. The Russians that are there, and they were all sleeping rough. The Russian people were all sleeping rough on the brickwork, and there were maggoty corpses because they didn't report anybody dying, because it meant cutting more rations off. But there were these dead bodies all around. They didn't have any bunks. And when we arrived, the Norwegians had been sent. The Germans tried to keep in with the Norwegians because of